Santana, hope you're feeling better. I had the great fortune to spend some time with Carlos Santana earlier this month. Some of you may know he lives here in Las Vegas now. I got an introduction, sat down to do an interview. We talked about shapeshifters and shaman and spiritual stuff. He told me that the ghost of Miles Davis has visited him a couple of times. I think Carlos Santana is a guy, he puts out a distinctive aura. I think he'd be a great guest to have on this program at some point, and I'm working on it. In the meantime, we're talking with Paul Davids about his excellent new film, Marilyn Monroe Declassified. The physical evidence, as we just heard, strongly suggests that, in fact, it proves that she didn't kill herself, either accidentally or on purpose. So who did it and why? We're going to get into that in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Paul Davids, before the break, you were talking about sort of the physical evidence, the crime scene itself, that indicated something was fishy about this. I found that one of the most compelling parts of that in your film is the fact that there were no dissolved capsules in her stomach. If she was taking these pills or capsules, there should be some evidence of that in her stomach, and there was none, suggesting strongly that the drugs that killed her were ingested some other way.
You know, in fairness, it was attempted to do as an experiment in one of the many television documentaries to try to show whether the stomach acids could have dissolved all of the the capsules. And there was somebody involved in that who claimed it could have happened. But I think the important point is that all of the people involved, with the autopsy, the medical evidence at the time, knew of no other case such as that. They always found residue of the capsules and a crystalline residue if it was taken orally. So some have tried to contradict this evidence, as I say, but I think that I think it stands up. It wasn't taken orally, and it was a contract killing.
All right, so let's talk about you've mentioned a couple of times different tapes and surveillance. In the film, I could ask the question, who was bugging Marilyn Monroe, but it may be easier to ask who wasn't. I mean, because it seems like a lot of people were listening to her phone.
Yes, and Peter Lawford and his estate in Malibu that President Kennedy visited so frequently. For Marilyn Monroe, the trouble started when she married playwright Arthur Miller, who wrote Death of a Salesman. Before that, she was married to Joe DiMaggio, the Yankee baseball player, and that didn't last, although they remained friends for life. But with Arthur Miller, he had strong communist sympathies and wrote for communist newspapers at the time of the House Un-American Activities Committee. So they were watching him, and he refused to testify, to name names in front of the committee. So he was in deep trouble. She had recently married him, so they began watching her too. And many of their friends had communist sympathies at that time, or were leftists. I mean, you mentioned Lee Strasberg, who was he created the Actors Studio, the actors' method, and Paula Strasberg was sort of the coach to Marilyn Monroe throughout most of the latter part of her career. And she had friends in Mexico. There was a Vanderbilt heir who was a communist, and she took a trip to Mexico and visited him and his leftist friends. And at that point, surveillance of her also fell to the CIA, because the CIA isn't supposed to do surveillance on people in the United States, continental United States, that's the FBI. But as soon as you're leaving the country and doing things that are raising questions, then the CIA gets into the act. And they did with her. So, yes, she was being bugged by law enforcement. J. Edgar Hoover was listening to the conversations. He knew everything that was happening between her and JFK. It turns out Robert Kennedy's phone at the Justice Department was bugged. And the other parties that were so interested in tapping the phones, it was the mob, the Teamsters, the Chicago Syndicate. That would mean Jimmy Hoffa, head of the Teamsters at that time, Sam Giancana, who was head of the Chicago Syndicate or Underworld, They call them the Outfit. And their reasons for hatred of the Kennedys, I mean, this was a real vendetta, went very, very deep. Because at first, Sam Giancana felt that he could trust the Kennedys not to make things hard on the mob, particularly in Chicago, because Joseph Kennedy, JFK's father, had appealed to him before the election, Kennedy-Nixon, to support Kennedy on the basis that a Kennedy administration would be much easier to deal with for the mob than Nixon. So Giancana thought he had a friend in the White House. And in fact, for a while, Kennedy was sending surreptitiously the FBI reports on the mob under the table to Sam Giancana and showing him what the FBI was doing to investigate him. It's shocking that he was providing that information. And through a liaison, Judith Exner Campbell, who was another mistress to JFK, and she was also a mistress to Sam Giancana, and she was a go-between, taking this information back and forth. Just shocking. So when Robert Kennedy was appointed Attorney General, well, even before that, with the Senate crime hearings, it became his mission to destroy the mob in America and put all of these quote-unquote gangsters behind bars. And he had Hoffa before the committee. He had Giancana before the committee. Very, very hostile interrogations. And I do have the original footage of that, you know, into the film, because it's important to understand the climate that existed where there was a war, in essence, going on between the government and the mob. And Marilyn Monroe, a friend of Frank Sinatra, who was connected with the Chicago gangsters, she's like a pawn caught right in the middle of it. And you know, a pawn, one of the first things to get knocked over on a chessboard. So she was in danger and didn't know it.
But Peter Lawford introduces JFK to Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
And they have an affair. And then it's strongly suggested she had an affair with Bobby Kennedy as well, as if John Kennedy passes her along. Or
yeah, you know, JFK asked Bobby Kennedy to step in and intervene to help Marilyn understand that JFK couldn't continue the friendship and liaison with her anymore, that the phone calls to the White House had to stop, that J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI, were aware of things that were being watched, it was too hot, and he had to get Marilyn to back off, and he sent his brother sort of as the messenger. Now, some of the critics of this information jump up and down saying, you know, oh, it's never proven that Bobby Kennedy had an affair with Marilyn Monroe. And I want to say that the whole scenario I present here and all this information, it doesn't depend upon that fact being true. The fact is, though, that they developed a close friendship and saw each other quite a number of times in those months from Marilyn Monroe singing Happy Birthday, Mr. President to JFK in the spring of 62 and up until Marilyn's death. So they were close. And then it came to a point where Bobby Kennedy felt that all contact had to be broken off and that she could be dangerous to them, particularly when she was voicing grievances about how she was being treated and felt that promises had been made to her. As a matter of fact, one of the books, I mentioned there's a number of books that I like by different authors. There's The Saga of Marilyn Monroe, Crypt 33 it's called, and it's by Adela Gregory and particularly Milo Spiriglio, who researched, very famous private detective in Hollywood. He researched the Marilyn Monroe case for, you know, half his life. And he claims that Marilyn got pregnant by RFK and that he promised her that he was going to divorce Ethel Kennedy and marry her, but he asked her to have an abortion and helped arrange an abortion. This is the claim. I'm not saying I think or I know it's true, but this was the claim that happened that summer. And he said, you know, let's have a future life together, but let's do it when it can be open and, you know, we can have children of our own. And that's the story.
Whether Bobby Kennedy had an affair with her or not, you make a pretty good, strong case that he was there.
Yes.
In L.A.,
absolutely.
Not in San Francisco, where he had an alibi on the day she died.
Yeah, absolutely. This was a huge part of the cover-up of Marilyn's murder, because though some still question it, such as the DD group, the Death Deliberation Group, which is an online group that argues about details of Marilyn's death, there's still some of those who don't think that Bobby Kennedy was in town that day. But he was. He absolutely was. And we have it from two police chiefs, both Chief Tom Redden and Chief Daryl Gates. We have about 18 witnesses of people in Los Angeles that saw them together that day. And it includes a policeman, a Beverly Hills cop, decorated cop named Lynn Franklin, who saw Peter Lawford speeding, stopped him speeding late that night with Robert Kennedy in the car. Decided not to give him a ticket, was told that they were trying, that the attorney general had to get out of town. He was here. But a complex alibi was set up for Bobby Kennedy, that he was giving a speech that weekend to some legal group in San Francisco, and his was staying with a few members of his family at a ranch of attorney John Bates in, I think it's Gilroy, California. So he couldn't be both at the ranch and in Los Angeles. And he had John Bates as sort of the alibi witness, saying he couldn't have been in two places at once. He was with me that whole weekend.
That interview clip you play of Bates is pretty
powerful,
intriguing though, isn't it?
Powerful. You just absolutely know he's lying. And one of the things I discovered that no one else has brought up, as I looked at the crime hearings, when Robert Kennedy is going after Monster Sam Giancana, and you look at who's the lawyer sitting beside Sam Giancana and whispering into his ear, it's John Bates. It's the same guy that put up Robert Kennedy for that weekend. He was the lawyer for the mobster Sam Giancana that Robert Kennedy was trying to put in jail. And he, it's also a fact that he was offered a major position in the Kennedy administration, and John Bates had turned it down. And, you know, the speculation is, once you're a lawyer for the mob, you're always a lawyer for the mob. And do you leave a lucrative position like that to go into government? He didn't. But it's very, very suspicious that that man was Robert Kennedy's alibi. Now, so, none of this says that Robert Kennedy was responsible for her death, but he was there and did see her that afternoon. That's the key point.
I think that's where some people would think the story is going. All right, John Kennedy had an affair with her. Robert Kennedy intervened. Whether he had an affair or not, he was the guy who was delivering the bad news. You got to knock it off, cut off all contact. This has to stop, which presumably could have set Marilyn Monroe off. Maybe the Kennedys were the ones who arranged to have her dead. But as you outline in the film, the CIA was listening to her phone. The FBI was listening to her phone. Hoffa had hired some people. The mob was listening in. And perhaps they all had differing motives, but that they had reasons to want her dead, not because they were worried about what she might say, but as a way to get at the Kennedys. Tell us that part of the story.
Well, this is really, really interesting. Let me begin by saying that there's a few of the key authors who disagree with me here, and I respect them. Everybody's entitled to their point of view. But people like Jay Margolis and Richard Buskin, whose 2014 book, The Murder of Marilyn Monroe, they think that Bobby Kennedy actually had a hand in killing Marilyn Monroe. And that in addition to seeing her that afternoon, that he returned later that night with two men with the medical kit, and that he actually held a pillow over her head while she was murdered. I don't think that happened. They think it happened partially because there was a lot of testimony about it from the son-in-law of the housekeeper. Years later, he came up with this detailed story. I don't know how reliable that testimony is. Also, Burleson, Don Burleson, who wrote CIA and the Murder of Marilyn Monroe, he thinks that Bobby Kennedy was responsible. However, there comes along a book called Double Cross from the Giancana family. They also put out a DVD about Sam Giancana, who was known as Momo. So it's the Momo story, something to that effect. And they claim, and this is his brother and a nephew write this book, and they say that Sam Giancana confessed to them that he put out the hit contract on Marilyn Monroe, that he had her killed. And that this is the twist I'm about to say that I felt connected so many of these pieces the way no other author had before. Because I don't know of any other of these major authors who has even talked about that CIA document that mentions the secret air base that could be the UFOs in the Roswell case. Only one other author, Donald Wolf, but he didn't quite know what to do with it. The point that I bring out is that Sam Giancana claimed that when he put out the contract to end Marilyn Monroe's life, that the contract came from the CIA. And that just rings a lot of alarm bells. Because, first of all, I do think that the Giancana family who brought forward this information is being truthful. You watch them on a tape, and I have them on a tape in this movie, and I do believe that the nephew, whose name is also Sam Giancana, is absolutely telling the truth of the confession of the famous mobster. But the CIA connection is mentioned. So now we have to remember that we have a CIA document signed by the director of counterintelligence, James Angleton, the day before she dies, a document that is all showing all this concern about things she knows that are classified that she should not know. And we know that Sam Giancana was working for the CIA. He had been working for the CIA for years, unbeknownst to Robert Kennedy. When Robert Kennedy found out, he absolutely hit the ceiling. He was furious. But the CIA had for years been using Sam Giancana as a kind of a arm's length hit squad. And they had him involved in the attempt to assassinate Fidel Castro. It failed, that attempt. But it didn't end Giancana's connection with the CIA. It even increased. You know, I don't know if I have the time to mention this, but part of the irony is that the FBI didn't know of this connection between Giancana and the CIA. And when Giancana landed at an airport in Chicago, there were FBI men there that harassed him and called him scum in front of newspaper people that were there and television news crews. And they just called him the scum of the earth. And this man felt he was being a patriot. He was working for the CIA, and he couldn't tell them. So it's a complex story, and he was a very complex man. You know, he was rejected from the Army for being psychotic, World War II. He arrested for car theft still in his teens. By the time he was 20 years old, he was questioned in 3 different murders. This was one of the major gangsters of American history, you know, on the scale of Al Capone, Sam Giancana.
Well, that plot to kill Castro, where the CIA reached out to the mob to do that, started here in Las Vegas. We've done a bunch of stories on it. Johnny Roselli was sort of a go-between.
Oh, we have
the
to talk about him, too, yeah.
Yeah, we will. Robert Mayhew, a former FBI agent who worked for Howard Hughes, makes all the introductions. Giancana. It was born here. There were multiple attempts. None of them worked. But it's interesting to me, and we'll get into this in the next segment, that it's the same cast of characters who pop up again
in the
assassination of JFK.
Yes, in the Kennedy assassination. Absolutely. Jack Ruby, who killed Lee Harvey Oswald. He was Sam Giancana's man in Dallas.
All right, we'll get into that in the next segment. I'll try to take a couple of calls. I know a lot of folks have questions for you about the Marilyn Monroe Declassified, the new Paul Davids film, and we'll take as many calls as we can, and maybe have Paul address on the other side, you know, exactly who did it and how it went down. His best guess on that in just a moment. We'll be back. Lou Reed takes us into the break. The song is called Sing the Changes. It was put out by a group, a duo known as the Firemen. That group had put out two previous albums, and no one knew who the duo was until that third album, and then you got vocals on the music, and it turns out one half of the duo is Paul McCartney, doing some experimental stuff, just using a different name and kind of having fun. We're talking with a different Paul, Balt Davids, about his new film, Marilyn Monroe Declassified. It's comprehensive, it's compelling, it's certainly thought-provoking. In a moment, I'll ask the sort of Paul to summarize who he thinks did it and what they were trying to accomplish, how Marilyn Monroe was caught in the middle of a maelstrom, and then we'll take a couple of your calls as well. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Paul Davids, we know from various means and evidence that the FBI was listening to Marilyn Monroe's phone and trying to collect dirt on the Kennedys because J. Edgar Hoover felt threatened. We know the CIA, the Kennedys had sort of cut the legs off the CIA and were in the process of dismantling it, so they had motives as well. We know the mob felt sort of double-crossed. We know Hoffa wanted dirt on the Kennedys. A lot of surveillance was underway, and it's not just from the documents. I mean, they physically found bugs in Marilyn's home. I guess when there was some remodeling done, there were bugs that were found in Peter Lawford's mansion. There were a lot of people who were looking for dirt. And here's Marilyn Monroe in the middle of all these forces she doesn't quite understand. She becomes a liability. Yeah. So why do you think she was killed then?
And we have the testimony of the wiretappers.
Yeah.
And in the film, one of them was sent to jail for life and died in prison, Bernard Spindell.
So what do you think the most likely scenario is, why she was killed, who did it, and what they were trying to accomplish?
Well, I think that the confession of Sam Giancana's family that the hit came down from the CIA. We have the CIA document. We have the signature of James Angleton on that document. We know he was involved in other intrigues having to do with Kennedy mistresses. Sam Giancana, according to the family, timed this for the day that they knew that Robert Kennedy was at the house, and they knew it from the wiretaps. So this was intended to entrap Bobby Kennedy by doing it that day. In essence, through his own action in going to her house, unknowingly, he was being set up for entrapment. But because it took 6 hours before her death was reported, fingerprints were cleaned up, any indication of letters from Robert Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe, you know, the house was cleaned up. They had 6 hours to do it. And Police Chief Tom Redden said that it was handled as a top secret intelligence operation. They used those 6 hours. But Sam Giancana hoped to wake up the next morning and see Robert Kennedy implicated in Marilyn Monroe's death. And he hoped that this would bring down the Kennedys. It didn't. It was all covered up. And covered up not because the Kennedys ordered her killed, in my opinion, but covered up because the Los Angeles police, and enlisting the cooperation of the coroner's office, protected Robert Kennedy, the attorney general. So that I think, was the scenario. It's why the truth has been withheld all these years, even in the 1980s when they tried to summon a grand jury to reopen it as a murder case. District Attorney Ira Reiner in Los Angeles shot it down and fired the foreman of the grand jury before they could get anywhere. So covered up for decades. So let's get the truth out now. My movie, Marilyn Monroe Declassified, gives people everything they know to come to a logical conclusion about what happened. As far as the actual hitmen involved, I defer to Milo Spiriglio, who studied this his whole life. You know, in his book, Crip 33, he names three people who, under Johnny Rosselli, went to her house. Now, you mentioned Johnny Rosselli. He was very close to Sam Giancana. He was the mob's man in Hollywood. Represented the Teamsters in Hollywood. You know, the Teamsters are a very important union in Hollywood. Rosselli was a friend of Frank Sinatra. Marilyn Monroe knew him. She knew him as a social acquaintance. So when he was sent by Sam Giancana to her home that night to knock on the door, and he had several men with him, she would have opened the door with the dog barking and everything. She would have opened the door for Johnny Roselli. She wouldn't have felt a threat. She would have known him. We think he was involved. And the three men named by Milo Spariglio in Crypt 33 are Phil Aldericio, known as Phil Milwaukee Aldericio.
Yeah.
Then there was Anthony the Ant Spilotro.
Spilotro was the Rackets boss of Las Vegas.
Yeah, Frank the German Schweiz.
Wow.
So they knew what drugs she had been taking. They used Nemitol as a suppository. That was what she had been prescribed. She was normally taking that. And Nemitol suppositories were used by the mob in other contract killings. It's part of the lexicon and part of the history. So I've done my best to unravel it, and I want to make one other key point here that comes from director Philippe Mora. You know, he directed the movie Communion. He is a terrific director, and he's in my film extensively because he discovered a key FBI document that first implicated Robert Kennedy. And Philippe Mora says the way he looks at this is really that the death of Marilyn Monroe was really the beginning of the turbulent 60s as we know it. It was the first assassination, and then came JFK and Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy and all of that mayhem and the death, the killing of Jack Ruby, Ruby's killing of Lee Harvey Oswald. You know, it just unleashed this cacophony of murder, assassination, cover-up. But he makes the point, didn't start with JFK, started a year earlier with the murder of icon Marilyn Monroe. And it's a different way to look at the 60s. And I think my film, in addition to giving a portrait of Marilyn's career, let's not leave that out, and how wonderful she was as an actress, it's not just about her death. But in addition to that, the film makes that point that we can look at this now as sociological history. We can look at it back as, you know, the CIA, the way it was. They did those things then. It's just fact. It's just part of history, and there's enough documentation to prove it.
Marilyn Monroe was such a tragic figure in a lot of ways. I mean, she portrayed this dumb blonde. She wasn't a dumb blonde. She was pretty sharp. She was a talented actress.
You know, she always said it. She was actually a brunette. You know, it was her platinum blonde. That was,
right.
You know, that was thanks to chemicals and dye. She always said it takes a smart brunette to play a dumb blonde.
She'd be 90 years old now, and you can't imagine her as a 90-year-old. You know, I guess in a sense she's frozen in time in the way that, James Dean can't imagine her being 90. But she's as alive now as she ever was, it seems, as we noted in the beginning.
Yes, and, you know, it's speculated that part of her becoming this immortal icon is attributable to the fact that she was cut down when she was so young. She was 36.
Let's take a couple of calls. West of the Rockies, Wayne in Tacoma. Hi, Wayne. You're on with Paul Davids.
Good morning, gentlemen. Yeah, I'm going to ring up another Antonio or Tony, a very famous singer in his own right. He had his own coast-to-coast television show sponsored by Pepsi-Cola in the early 50s out of Hollywood, the Tony Fontaine Entertainment or Variety Show. And his wife, Carrie Vaughn, was an actress, and they both were very good friends of Marilyn's. In fact, after they had their first baby in the early 50s, Marilyn, when she was living with Shelley Winters, used to babysit for them. And he said that Marilyn would never have committed suicide, that she was an extremely smart, brilliant woman. And I had a question, too, because there was some connection between one of the supposedly made one of the mafiosos and Marilyn Monroe at a mountain retreat around this time, too. Can you tell me about that?
That was the Cal Neva retreat, where Frank Sinatra was the primary owner. It was a retreat and casino, and Sam Giancana had an interest in it. And they sort of lured Marilyn Monroe up there. I think it was the weekend before her death, and Sam Giancana took advantage of Marilyn Monroe in terrible ways. She was drunk, she was out of her mind, and there were compromising pictures taken that Frank Sinatra later insisted be burned. It was a terrible moment for her. Peter Lawford was there with her, and they flew back to L.A. on the same plane. And he got on the phone for 20 minutes with the people that were supposed to drive him back to his house. But he stopped them, and he got on a payphone, which wouldn't be tapped, and he talked for 20 minutes. And it's thought that that was a call to the White House and to JFK, and that JFK was brought up to date. And, you know, Marilyn was at that point threatening to go public. She told a number of people she was threatening to go public with how she had been abused and treated. And, of course, that press conference never happened.
Wayne, thanks for the call. I know some of that, part of that story is confirmable because Frank Sinatra had a Nevada gaming license then and got into all kinds of trouble because Sam Giancana was at his property at that time.
Yeah, they took away his gaming license.
Right. We'll go to first-time caller Steve in Torrance, California. Hi, Steve. Steve, are you there? Steve is apparently gone. All right, we're going to go to the wild card line. Chris in Ferguson, Missouri. Hi, Chris.
Oh, how you doing? George and Paul, this is wonderful that you're doing this. In 1965, I was 12 years old, and I was watching What's My Line? And Dorothy Kilgallen said live on TV, "I know who killed President Kennedy," because she was seeing Ruby in jail. She said, "I know who killed President Kennedy." That was in the summer. By November the 8th, she died. Somebody killed her. Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy Kilgallen were best of friends.
They certainly knew each other. There's photographs of them together.
Yes, they said
that the Dorothy Kilgallen death was drug overdose to, like, the Marilyn case. And that she had been writing some manuscript that would have exposed these things, and of course that was never found. So Dorothy Kilgallen was the one who was being wiretapped when she said Marilyn was told, when she heard Marilyn was told that JFK took a visit to a secret airbase for the purpose of seeing things from outer space, which for me, I want to just say, so it gets on the record here, as the producer of the movie Roswell, and I've always believed that that was extraterrestrial contact, and it has been withheld from the public all this time. So for me, I take that as a kind of a confirmation, another confirmation of all the others that Roswell was real. President Kennedy knew it, and he had talked to Marilyn about it.
Chris, thanks for that call. Let's talk about that for a second, Paul. So how do you figure that worked, that JFK was read into that program, that he knew about Roswell? I was speculating that maybe he had visited Area 51 because he did come to the Nevada test site, but I think the timing for when he told Marilyn suggests maybe he went to Wright Pat instead.
Well, I don't think it was Wright Pat, and I don't know if it was called Area 51 then. And I apologize that I don't know the name of the base, but someone at one of the conferences came up to me and told me, you know what, there was even an article, I think in the New York Times, around that time of JFK going to a base in the desert, and the base was named. I don't know which one. So we don't know where those bodies were when at different points in time, or the debris. I mean, certainly we think Wright Patterson was involved and they were there for part
of
it.
So you think JFK pillow talk tells Marilyn, hey, we've got stuff from outer space
that
somewhere.
The aliens are real. And it's also known that he made a request for all of the UFO documents that were classified soon before his death. I think this was within, 2 weeks before his assassination, he was beginning to probe on the UFO thing. It all suggests that he knew. And all of us just have to take a deep breath and step back and say, wow, of all the cover-ups, we've never been told the truth about the JFK assassination and, 100 other things. Maybe we don't know the truth about the Lincoln assassination. Who knows what they're withholding from us? But I, for one, certainly believe that they've withheld from us, from at least 1947 and maybe 1942, the fact that they know for a fact that there are intelligent extraterrestrials that are visiting this planet. And I think that is, I wish it would come to an end.
You think that Marilyn Monroe conveyed this information to Dorothy Kilgallen, or Kilgallen had her own sources?
I think she conveyed it to friends, and there was one friend of Dorothy Kilgallen that had that phone call with her that it popped out in that wiretap. Let's see, I think I've got his name right here, as a matter of fact. I think it was like Rothberg, something like that. The CIA document was about a conversation between that man, who I think was Rothberg, and Dorothy Kilgallen.
Try to get another call in on Wildcard 3, Miranda from Los Angeles, who has her own personal take on this. Hi, Miranda.
Hi, so nice to speak with you, and I think the story is just incredible. It kind of hits a nerve in my heart because I don't know if Paul knows that August the 5th, 7 days, 7 years prior, Carmen Miranda died August the 5th, and that's my mother. And the other interesting thing is the detective, Bill Bechtel, on my case had tremendous difficulty dealing with the authorities because there was, you know, contra information, you know, layers of information, because this is before computers. And then the people who adopted me were close friends with the Kennedys, and also they worked at Area 51. And my book is just about to come out, and I'm still in the heat of some very complicated findings, and the people who had adopted me are probably the most complicated, difficult people in the world. Mm-hmm. And I'm lucky to be alive, and I'm happy to just have this moment to say, this is awesome what you're doing, Mr. Davis, and God bless you. And, you know, some of these stories are meant to get out, and keep me in your prayers because mine needs to be told too, and it's about as hairy as yours.
Thank you.
Thanks, Miranda. Well, let us know when your book comes out. We'll take a look at it. So anything else? I think, Paul, we got about 2 minutes left.
Yeah, Howard Rothberg was the name that I was looking for there. The other thing, I'd just like, while I've got a chance, your listeners have heard me talk about my film, The Life After Death Project. That was with George Noory, and you and I spoke about my book, An Atheist in Heaven, The Ultimate Evidence for Life After Death, which I wrote with Dr. Gary Schwartz. And that was about the afterlife case of Forrest J. Ackerman. Like them to know that this week in Los Angeles, the city council, we dedicated Forrest J. Ackerman Square in Los Angeles, honoring him in that way through the vote of the Los Angeles City Council, right near the House of Pies at Franklin in Vermont, where Fari used to go for meals all the time during his last 6 years when he lived in a little house nearby. So pleased that Fari got that honor. And I hope your listeners will remember to look into my book, An Atheist in Heaven, and the film that went with it, The Life After Death Project.
And then this one is on DVD and Blu-ray, Marilyn Monroe Declassified.
Marilyn Monroe Declassified.
Check it out.
Yep. Came out in September.
Thanks, Paul. It's always interesting to have you here. Let me know what you're working on.
George, you're great. Thanks for all your great questions.
Talk to you again. And this is it's a lot to chew on in this documentary. In a moment, Tom Powell. We switch gears. Tom Powell will be here to talk about his new book, Edges of Science. Bigfoot is one focus, but it branches out into entirely different kinds of subject matter that I think a lot of you will find familiar. James Taylor, Country Road, takes us into the break on Coast to Coast AM.